Fantasy writers, I hope you'll be joining me for the All About Fantasy full-day virtual retreat on the 28th of September from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Whether you write YA fantasy, romantasy, adult fantasy, epic fantasy, cozy fantasy, dystopian fiction, or any other variation of the genre, you won't want to miss out on this amazing day of learning dedicated especially to you and those writing in your genre. The lineup includes award-winning and best-selling authors, as well as literary agents and editors who specialize in the genre. You'll have an opportunity to submit your query letter for critique. The Story Engine, who is sponsoring the retreat, is also hosting an awesome giveaway of an All Things Fantasy storytelling package that contains a copy of each of their decks, Story Engine Deck and Deck of Worlds, each with their associated fantasy expansions, the mythology, dystopian, and fairy tale boosters, valued at $237. All delegates will also receive discounts when shopping on the Story Engine website. Come and learn, ask questions, and even more importantly, build community. To find out more and to register, go to my website, biancamaray.com, and look for the All About Fantasy tab. I hope to see you there. Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. Now, this particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 30th of September, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of October. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab. Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. We'll be taking a break from recording new Books with Hooks segments over the summer so that we can recharge our batteries and return fully energized in the fall. We'll still be critiquing two new Books with Hooks submissions each week, though, which our paid Substack subscribers will get every Tuesday through our newsletter. That's until we return with new segments to air in the fall. So continue to submit your queries to us through our website. In the meantime, we'll be kicking it back by playing Books with Hooks episodes from our backlist while still airing brand new author interviews each week. Hi everyone, welcome to another Books with Hooks. Today we have two authors joining us, Jessica and Kate, and Carly and Cece are going to be looking at their query letters. So first up is Jessica. Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so Jessica, can you begin by reading us your query letter?
Sure. I'm getting over the flu, so hopefully I will make it through without problems. All right, so dear Bianca, Carly, and Cece, I'm a big fan of all three of you and have learned so much from the podcast, book club, and the virtual retreat. Thank you for all that you do. Down We Fall is my 98,000-word, multi-point-of-view women's fiction novel that combines a similar grief reaction, as in the memoir Wild by Cheryl Strayed, with the loss and self-discovery in Jill Santopolo's More Than Words and Marissa De Los Santos's I'd Give Anything. Bryn Ellison never knows if the next jump will be her last. On the outside, she's a composed and accomplished medical student, but on the inside, she's screaming, becoming more and more desperate to feel connected to a world she holds at arm's length. Tormented by the loss of her mother and a horrific accident that she believes was her fault, Bryn secrets away every chance she gets to skydive, bungee, or base jump. The higher the risk, the more she's able to actually feel something. Jacob, a fellow medical student, has been enamored with Bryn since they first met. Just as he convinces her to turn their friendship into romance, he invites her on a group trip home to meet his family. To Bryn, he's the perfect guy, but she's not sure she's capable of romantic feelings. That is, until she meets his older brother Caleb, and the intense attraction they share tells her that she had been wrong. The two can't help but gravitate toward each other despite neither wanting to hurt Jacob. But when tragedy strikes the brother's family and Jacob discovers their betrayal, Caleb is torn between Bryn and family loyalty and Bryn risks returning to the one thing that had always allowed her some solace and escape, even if that means escalating the danger to even higher levels than before. By day, I'm a physician working in a large academic teaching hospital. By night, I'm either still stuck at the hospital, or I'm home with my husband and four little ones, two human, two with fur, on an unending loop of editing or adding to my next novel. I am part of a writing group formed via Women's Fiction Writers Association. A sample of this manuscript won Best Manuscript Submission at the Atlanta Writers Conference in 2021, awarded by an associate editor of a Simon & Schuster imprint. Although published in scientific journals, this is my first piece for the literary world. Thank you so much for your time and consideration.
Wonderful, Jessica. Thank you so much. Okay, we're now going to hand over to Cece.
Thank you so much for that very excellent reading, Jessica. Okay, I want to get to the points. First of all, I don't know if you know this about me. I love skydiving. Like love, love, love skydiving. My favorite thing is hang gliding, but skydiving is definitely a second. I've never done base jumping. Don't plan to do that. Do not enjoy bungee jumping. Only done that once. But yes, I love jumping from very high altitudes. I have the best time. It's very weird because otherwise my personality is just very, very like stay at home and read books. So this was a lot of fun for me to read is what I'm saying, right? I was like, oh, okay. I get that her motivations to jump aren't the happiest, but it's still really interesting. So you've managed to like present a character in a query letter that is layered. That is really hard to do. And that was excellent. So excellent job. Few notes. One thing, and this I am assuming based on what I read in your query letter and based on the tone that I'm sensing that your novel is going to have, that this is unintentional. If it is intentional, keep it. But if it's not intentional and I'm right, I would edit this thing that I'm about to say. Just as he convinces her to turn their friendship into romance, I don't think that it's your intention for him to come across as like not respecting no means no, because that's just not what the book is, right? So maybe we reframe that. Because I know that like, again, I can just tell by the tone that this is not that kind of novel. So yeah, I would just reframe that. You don't want it to seem like he's just not respecting her boundaries, that he's being pushy, that he's being aggressive, that he's being, you know, a creepy guy, because that's not who Jacob is. Okay, so that's one note. And then the other note that I have is the major dramatic question seems a little looser than I would want it to be. I think it's just a matter of framing. And I think that when we get to your pages and you tell me a little bit more about what's going to happen, because I'm going to ask you that, we might have a solution. It's working, but right now it feels like all these different things are happening and we have her internal conflict. Whereas I would have preferred perhaps that the web effect happened more, meaning like all the plot points come together in a way that feels completely inevitable. And now everything is just layered on top of each other. I will say though, that this is me like, I guess just being extra critical because you're here and that's our job. Our job is to essentially poke holes. Because when I read the part that she goes home to meet his family and she falls for his brother, that to me, like that is a novel I will read. Like I would absolutely read that. It sounds twisty. It sounds like there's going to be low-key family drama. Like not low-key because it's a big deal, but you know what I'm saying, right? Like it feels like the kind of relationship drama that I love to read about. So love the twist. Would absolutely read this. Love the character. I love her already. So excellent job. Thank you so much for sharing.
Wonderful, Cece. Thank you. High praise indeed. Okay, Jessica, now it's your turn to come back with any questions you have, any answers you have before we move on to the actual pages.
Yeah, thank you so much for the feedback. I definitely did not want Jacob to come across like that. It was more of like sensing her hesitation. You know, she's not really feeling it, but he's such a great guy. And so I will rework that. So thank you for that. And then, yeah, I've had 18 million iterations of this query letter and trying to figure out how much to put in, when to kind of hold back. Do I basically tell what her emotional arc is or tease that further? I didn't know. And with this particular query letter, I stopped pretty short. So I think we can maybe come back to this after we talk about the first chapter, because I would love to get your thoughts on that and maybe even kind of tell you where I had gone originally and where I pulled back.
I love that idea. Let's absolutely do that. And that is 100% the challenge of all query letters, right? Like how much do you reveal? How much do you withhold? So yeah, if she's going to date Jacob simply because her life is in the right place for her to date Jacob, make it about her, you know, don't make it about him convincing her. That's the only thing I'd say.
Awesome, Cece. Thank you. Okay, Jessica, do you have any more questions or can you tell us a bit more about the opening pages?
I will summarize the opening pages and then I do have several questions. Okay. So the scene opens with Bren climbing up to stand on the ledge of a bridge. You know, her heart's pounding. She's looking down into this canyon, but instead of feeling really scared, she actually feels very alive and energized compared to this numb state that she's normally in. So we're quickly told that she's wearing a harness. So this is a bungee jump. And as she's standing there about to jump, she sort of describes internally this overwhelming pull towards recklessness, and which actually is a psychological term called l'appel du vide, which in French, and it translates to call of the void. And it's just this impulse toward danger that, you know, normal people can have, but they usually don't act on them. But Bren feels like ever since this tragic accident that killed her mother as a child, that, you know, she's not really been able to escape this feeling. And when she finally does jump, you know, there's this initial thrill of it, but that quickly fades into something deeper, which is her trying to connect with her mother and to feel what her mother's last moments might have been like. So when the jump is over, the guy that was helping her with the jump, you know, asks her if she enjoyed it. She says no, which takes him by surprise. And she internally expresses disappointment that the jump really isn't doing it for her anymore. And she sort of needs to up the ante to get the same feelings and level of sensations that she's after. And later, when she's in her room in this little hostel, we find out that she's in medical school. And instead of going out with the class in celebration of summer break, she sneaks away to do this without telling anyone. So this is very a secretive part of her life. Then there's a knock on her door, and the guy that had helped her with her jump earlier invites her to a cookout. She politely declines, but he's clearly curious about her and asks if she's jumped before, which she has. Then he asks if she skydives. She says yes. And she can tell during this conversation that he's really into this world of extreme sports and thinks she is too, but she doesn't really see herself that way. Yes, she does these things, but the reasons for doing them are very different. You know, she's not a thrill seeker. She's really looking for solace. However, when he invites her to base jump, which sort of is like taking the extreme sport thing to the most dangerous level you can, she sees that as an opportunity and agrees to go along.
Wonderful, Jessica. Thank you. And I feel like I've just been diagnosed here because I cannot stand on a balcony. And even if we go to a Blue Jays game or the theater, I cannot be anywhere that's elevated right on the balcony because I feel the void calling to me. And those are the exact words I use. And I didn't know it was actually a diagnosis. So I'm going to be Googling the crap out of this.
It's a real thing. And there's actually, like, you know, scientific papers about it and everything. So you self-diagnosed.
This is amazing. And, you know, people, my friends keep saying, are you suicidal? And I'm like, no, I'm not suicidal, but I do just want to jump every time I'm close to the edge. It's a hell of a thing to not jump. Okay, Cece, let's hear what you thought.
Okay, so I have a lot of notes. We'll not have time for all my notes. So I'm not going to talk about the micro stuff. Stuff like using different fonts for text messages, line breaks. You're going to see that when you get my written notes. If you have any questions, reach out to me, okay? Let's focus on big picture stuff. So Jessica, I think you have a perfect movie beginning. If this were a movie, this would be the right place to start because we would see the protagonist, like we would probably start with her feet on the edge of something and we would see the fall, right? And it would be like, oh my gosh, very cinematic, immediately compelling. And then we would quickly, very quickly see her harness. So we wouldn't think anything such as death by suicide or anything like that, right? And then we would be like, okay, so why is she jumping? And we would see the people behind her. We would see them probably whispering like, is she okay? Usually people are either scared or excited and she's neither. She's just like disassociating or something, right? So we'd have the people whispering. And then we'd have maybe even voiceover with her thoughts or maybe like a flash to her mom's face. And then we'd see her jump. And it would be really short and really compelling. Don't think it works as a book. It could if, again, we'll talk, but I just don't think it's the right book beginning. I think it's the right movie beginning. When you write the screenplay for this, you can choose this as a starting point. It doesn't translate as well in book format. It's too internal, and internal can work. I've seen novels where it's just the character by themselves at the first scene and it works. But you know what all those novels have? I'm curious about what's going to happen next in those novels. In your pages, I'm curious about what happened before. Curiosity about what happened before is great, but we also need curiosity about what's going to happen next. So we might be able to still make this work if we can find a way to weave in a curiosity seed about what's next. Something to think about. But yes, just being totally honest, right now I'm curious about what happened before. One question to ask yourself that I encourage all readers to ask themselves, what do you want the reader to think at the start of your novel? In what ways do your pages confirm that and surprise them? It could be small, it could be big, it depends on the genre. The problem with this beginning is that the only thing that I can think of, actually the two things that I can think of, don't work, because what you could surprise the reader is making them think she's going to kill herself, and then she's not actually going to kill herself. But you don't want to do that, because like that's just super triggering and icky and not your novel, right? So I can't think of... I also thought that she could be messing with the men there. Like, they think she's scared and she's kind of like letting them think she's scared. And then actually she's super like a daredevil brave person. But she wouldn't be able to be disassociating if she's going to mess with people. So that doesn't work either. So truth is, I have no idea how to make this scene work with story forward curiosity. But you might not even agree with my note, which is totally fine because you're the creator of this world. One adjacent note, which you might be able to adopt whether or not you agree with this part of my note so far, is you mentioned her mom, in my opinion, way too many times. The explanation of the connection between her mom and what she does is on the second paragraph, I believe, or third, or it's like right on the first page. It's, you know, they've been constant since those early days after her mother's accident, where she can still remember the feeling of pressing her hands against the cold glass window of her 11th floor hospital room, her head bandaged, wondering what she would do if the glass suddenly shattered. And then we have four more references to her mom and how this is all about her mom. I don't think it's in your best interest to spell it out so clearly. Like, I do this and I've been doing this since the accident with my mom. You know, I just think that it's giving away all the explanation as opposed to making me curious. And I wonder if there's an opportunity to make it into a curiosity seed. Don't know. Again, I'm mindful because these are such big themes. I don't want to make this into something that it's not. But when it comes to story forward stuff, perhaps something that we could up with the hot date question, because I'm assuming the hot date is Jacob. So maybe something like that, like her interiority could be focused on that. I don't know. I want to hear from you. I'm here to brainstorm if you want to. I think that you have a really great beginning, but I just don't think it's absolutely phenomenal, you know? And we do live in a world where absolutely phenomenal is necessary. And speaking of her interiority, this is a general interiority note for everyone. If there's a knock on the door, your protagonist is supposed to have theories about who is on the other side. The theories can be wild. It can be something like, even though it was completely irrational, she thought that it might be her mother. I know she's not actually going to think this. Or it could be, oh my gosh, could it be rooms? I don't know. But there's no such thing as a knock on the door and then their mind is blank. Who could it be? Human beings theorize in specifics. Okay, I will stop talking now.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, so before we go to Jessica, something that Cece just said has really resonated with me. And it's a question I have for you, Jessica, in terms of the character arc. How important is it that she's aware up front why she's behaving the way she is? Because that makes her incredibly self-aware. And in terms of character arc, you know, if you begin with a character who isn't as self-aware, but during the course of the story, they start to realize why they're doing the things that they're doing, and it becomes part of their journey and part of their character arc and how they change, you know, that becomes a bit more compelling for the reader, because in the beginning, the reader's like, why is this character doing the stuff that they're doing? But of course, the character themselves, you know, shouldn't know the reason why themselves. They should just feel compelled to behave in this way. So that's just my question to you. How important is it for her to be that self-aware at the beginning of the novel?
So to kind of get to both of y'all's points, which thank you so much, by the way. So it was funny because I actually had beta reader. I originally wrote this scene and I just said her. I want to feel what she felt. And you don't actually even know who I'm talking about. It never mentions her mother at all. And so you're like, what in the world is she doing? And why is she doing this? And who is she thinking of? And what happened to that person? And I was much more vague. And my writing group had mentioned that vagueness on to that degree, and maybe I just didn't do it as well as I needed to, was like driving them crazy. Like, I needed to get to link it a little bit more and ground them a little bit more. And, you know, why are you hiding the mother thing up front? And so that's actually why I went back and redid it. And maybe there's a way to kind of compromise between those two things. And then to Bianca, to your point about how important is that in the character arc, when I first was writing this novel, I didn't actually know why she was doing this. This is actually based on a real person. And so I was thinking through this, trying to like work it out for myself. And then whenever I kind of like thought, you know, here's what it is. It was more that I took the character arc a step further, and it was more of like, it's no longer working for her. And she's trying to escalate things as a maladaptive response rather than deal with like the grief and the guilt and the trauma of what happened. And so sort of the climax of the story is her realizing that this is futile, and she really has to deal with the actual trauma and guilt of it before she's going to ever be able to move on.
Okay, so just before I hand back to Cece, who I know will want to say some things about the difference between curiosity and confusion in the early pages with regards to your beta reader's feedback. So what I want to say is, remember that the character at the midpoint of a novel can have some kind of realization that then leads to the rest of the character arc you're talking about. So it could be that at the beginning, she's doing this kind of behavior and she really has no idea why. She, maybe other people in her life kind of suspect, but she hasn't seen it yet. And you can have it that, you know, at the midpoint mark, somewhere in act two, she realizes this either through a therapist or someone talks to her, and then she goes on to the rest of the things that you were speaking about. And I certainly think that would intrigue the reader a lot more than having a super self-aware character up front. Because remember, really self-aware characters generally have their shit together. You know, the more self-aware we are as human beings, the kind of more we have our shit together. And we don't want a character in the beginning who's got their shit together, because then why are we going on this journey with them? You know, so I really think it will be helpful if she isn't quite as aware of that, and that becomes something she learns. Cece, in terms of, you know, you don't want to frustrate your readers in the opening pages by alluding to something too much and they feel manipulated, but you want to plant the curiosity seed. So what's your take on that?
I want to first backtrack and say that I agree with everything you just said, Bianca, about the self-awareness. You nailed it. It's true for characters. However, for people, I am very self-aware. I don't have anything together, let alone my shit. But yeah, very self-aware human. Okay, back to the question. Jessica, thank you for saying that about your beta readers. That's really important feedback. What I think is that it's a spectrum, right? Like, you were just using a her and giving no context. And now you're saying her mom, and there are literal lines going, was her mom feeling this weightlessness? Is her mom in the air with her? So it's about calibrating. So that's one thing. But it's also about that interiority happening against a backdrop of something that also keeps us curious in terms of like her interacting with someone or something else that's going on. An idea I had, don't know if it works because I know she's not taking calls, but an idea I had is that she could answer a phone call and there are people around her, right? Because you don't bungee jump in alone. There's obviously people in line and the instructor guy and etc. She could answer the call and say, I'm actually just pulling up to my garage and I can't talk right now. And then when she hangs up, maybe, you know, some guy in line or something says something like, oh, were you lying to your boyfriend? Does he not know you do this? I don't know what it could be, but the sheer fact that she would be lying about where she is and not no one knowing where she is, which you do tell us, but right up front, that alone could be an interesting backdrop to the interiority, which will calibrate, right? Like, it won't be a vague her or a, this is my mother, this is why I do this. Because it is also about making sure that your scene has enough layers. Your opening scene needs to be doing so much heavy lifting in a way that feels totally subtle and seamless. I know that these expectations are bonkers, by the way, like, I'm totally aware, but you're a doctor. You're used to bonkers expectations, right? Like, so this must be a breeze for you. Well, not a breeze, but you get it. Cause you know, a doctor.
Yes, high expectations. Different part of my brain, though, for this world. All right. Well, I did have a couple of other questions. I guess for one, just back to the sort of the query letter itself, are you all hearing or seeing alternate names for women's fiction now already?
Wait, do you mean the genre? Oh, yes. Carly, do you want to speak to this? Or I don't know if you're the positioning queen.
Yeah, I can speak to it a little bit. So in terms of the women's fiction as a category, I think that's a really interesting question, Jessica. I don't believe we have repositioned it entirely. So I do think you can use it. I don't think that you need to think of something alternate unless you just want to say kind of commercial fiction or upmarket, you know, like wherever you imagine it kind of fitting in that spectrum. I agree with you. It's a problematic term. I think a lot of people agree it's a problematic term. However, it is still used around the industry as a marker and a signpost for who the potential audience is. So therefore, we are still using the term. So yeah, we haven't found our way through that journey yet. But when I do, I will let you know.
Jessica, for years I had in my manuscript wish list, like, Cece doesn't believe in the term women's fiction. But for the sake of clarity, that is what she is looking for. Because yeah, it's what I like to read, but it's silly that there's no men's fiction, right? Like, so men become default and then women become niche, which is, again, very silly. But I think you can still call it that. You don't have to if you don't want to, but I will still understand what you mean, though. And unfortunately, because of that, because of the clarity around that term, because I immediately know what you mean, it might just be the best term to use.
Perfect. Thank you. And as far as my comps, I kind of threw in a weird one, but I thought it kind of captured the spirit of it with Wild by Cheryl Strayed. I just wanted feedback on that because that was sort of a last minute addition.
It did throw me off. I didn't really see how it fit, to be perfectly honest, but I am someone who, if the plot paragraph hooks me, I'll figure out comps with my client when I'm working with them. Not to say that you shouldn't focus on comps, because comps are super, super important. But yeah, it did throw me off. I mean, I don't know enough about your story to know if it does fit, of course, but it just didn't seem like the right comp for me. But the plot paragraph is doing wonders for my curiosity, though.
So just on that, I think Jessica's adding that to show a woman engaged in risky behavior as a result of grief. And I think that's why she's put that comp in. Is there a way to, like, maybe just say that, you know, in a sentence when she mentions the comp so that they know that that's the part she's going for?
Well, she could actually phrase it like you just did. However, if that's the only reason why you're using Wild, I would just let the plot paragraph do that heavy lifting, you know, and use a different comp, because they're just totally different books. I get the motivation of the character, right? But the plot paragraph already tells me that that's what she's doing. She's engaging in risky behavior. The first line tells me that.
Perhaps, Jessica, you want to phone into our Ask for Comps helpline and tell our bookseller a bit about it and see if she can come up with comps that are better suited, you know, to fiction.
That's a great idea, because I had trouble finding that piece of it, which I think is a huge part of, you know, my story. So, and then another question I had was, you know, the best manuscript submission, I know it probably doesn't hurt to add it, but is that even a big deal enough at one of these conferences to include and waste precious real estate? Because I feel like I'm already on a little bit on the longer end.
I would keep it. I think it's impressive. Like you said, it will not hurt. I would be very proud about that. So I would definitely keep it. And since we are running up on time, I would love to see this whenever you're ready. I just need to know what's going to happen with Caleb and Bryn. Is it Bryn? I don't remember the other brother's name now. But I need to know what's going to happen to her. Like, guys, I'm very curious. No, Bryn is the protagonist. Wait, what's the brother's name? Jacob. I forget the brother's name.
Jacob.
No, but the other brother. Oh, we don't know the other brother.
Jacob Caleb. And Caleb.
Yeah. Caleb. I need to know what's going to happen. Is Bryn going to choose Jacob? Is she going to choose Caleb? Is she going to choose neither? I need to know what's going to happen.
It gets real dramatic, and yes, absolutely. I would love that.
Wonderful. Well, that's always wonderful when our agents request more pages. So that's awesome for you, Jessica. Thank you so much for joining us on the show, and enjoy the rest of your day and don't work too hard. And thanks again for joining us on Thanksgiving.
Thank you so much, you all. I really appreciate all the feedback.
All right, that's it from Jessica. Now we're moving on to Kate. Kate, welcome to the show and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you all so much for having me. And I'm going to apologize in advance. I've got a little bit of congestion. So if I sound huskier than normal, not that you'd know what my normal is, that's what's going on.
It sounds fabulous. So it's all good. And thanks as well for joining us on Thanksgiving. Okay, could you read us your query letter, please?
Sure. Dear Carly Waters, The Other Matilda is a 100,000-word historical novel based closely on true events in 12th-century England, mixed with a tongue-in-cheek critique of modern politics. Princess by birth, empress by marriage, and sole heir to the Kingdom of England, Matilda is more fit to rule than anyone. Just ask her. When her cocky numbskull cousin Stephen usurps her throne in the wake of her father's sudden death, Empress Matilda vows to get it back and punish the cowardly nobles who enabled Stephen's theft. But Matilda has forgotten what makes Stephen so powerful. His radiant, adorable wife, the other Matilda. Across decades of civil war, the Empress chooses to wage a war for her own kingdom, while the other Matilda is happier as the power behind her husband's throne. Each woman dangerously misunderstands and underestimates the other. When at last they come face to face, they must both reckon with what it means and what it costs to be a woman of power in the 12th century. To find a way beyond total war, Empress Matilda must learn how to wield a strength far fiercer than a throne or a sword. Bringing a refreshingly modern voice to medieval historical fiction, it combines the irreverent humor of Hulu's The Great with the layered portrait of 12th century women found in Lauren Groff's Matrix. Empress Matilda has long received short shrift in the few novels that mention her, cast too often simply as a harpy or a tragic paramour. She was a complex woman larger than life and before her time. The Other Matilda is my attempt to give her due in fiction, warts and all. It would be my debut novel. Thank you for your consideration.
Wonderful, Kate. Thank you so much. Okay, now we're getting to Carly. Carly, what was your take on the query letter?
All right. So a new thing we've been doing on the podcast is saying how long query letters are. So this one, 283 words. And so I give you tons of props for how much information, especially in kind of like a world building type of book. It's historical. So there's a certain element of world building here that you accomplished in 283 words. So well done for that. But really, I mean, to me, this is just an excellent mix of the kind of historical topic, but making it so relevant. And you're also very aware that you're doing it. And this comes through in the style of the query letter, as well as the actual pages themselves. So I like how you accomplish that. I think this is so smooth, and it's easy to look at this and think that it was easy. I know it's really hard. You probably worked very hard on this to accomplish this. And so I think you did a really, really great job. I loved that TV show, The Great. I think it was a really, really fun, cheeky show. And I agree that the tone is very similar to what you're trying to accomplish here. I love Lauren Groff's The Matrix. I love everything Lauren Groff does. But The Matrix, definitely her most recent book and such a great book. So I think overall, my questions here in terms of the query are, is this a dual POV? Because our title kind of alludes to the fact, like, the other Matilda, and we also explain, like, you know, the other Matilda is kind of happier behind the throne. You know, we know that she exists and she's living a life. I just don't know how much we get into her life. Is it dual POV? How do we access that knowledge? I'm really curious about that piece. And I'm also curious, and it's not something you have to necessarily address in the query letter, but I am interested in how you're going to be handling these gaps in time, because you have across decades, plural, of civil war, right? And so Lauren Groff's novel is more literary than yours in terms of what I kind of imagine your book to be. Obviously, I haven't read it all. So yeah, she's handling huge gaps of time for sure. And a lot of historical novels do, because things take a long time to happen sometimes when letters are traveling back and forth between countries, you know, as you said, decades of civil war. So I guess I'm just kind of curious about how we're going to be keeping up with the stakes and the tension and the drama when we're crossing huge decades of time. That piece is kind of interesting to me. A comp that you didn't use, which I don't think you need to, but I was kind of curious, you know, I think Philippa Gregory is obviously one of the queens of historical fiction written in a modern, accessible way. I don't think you need to add her in, but I think you're on par there in terms of like what you're trying to accomplish in a very self-aware historical context kind of situation. So yeah, no, I think this is really interesting, but I'm mostly, as I said, curious to hear you speak a little bit about the kind of the structure and the dual POV or all of that sort of it.
Wonderful, Carly. Thank you. Okay, Kate, this is your opportunity to ask questions or give Carly feedback.
Yeah, well, thank you. I really appreciate that feedback. And the dual POV thing was something I was thinking of as I was rereading this over and over again to prepare for today. I realized it really wasn't clear. And this morning, I almost wondered when I was reading it again, did it seem like there was something, like I was getting at some kind of weird, like, personality split? And that's not what I was trying to imply. And that didn't come across, I hope, because it is two different people. So yes, it's a bit of a dual POV, and I'm kind of in the final editing stages. I'm still actually trying to figure out if I want to just cut the other POV altogether or make it much more even. Because right now I'd say it's probably 20-80 with the other Matilda, which is kind of maybe an unusual weight to give to a second POV. So I think when I sort of make that final decision, I'm going to have to make the query letter kind of reflect what is the balance. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, that makes perfect sense. It's so hard for me to advise on that at this stage, obviously, because I haven't seen it, haven't seen the full manuscript. I always worry when we only have 20% of another voice that it's just being used as a manipulative scaffolding type of tool to like get the reader to where you want them to be. So I'm always pretty much like, it needs to be in one POV or it needs to be like equal or nearly equal, in my opinion. It's just because I'm rarely proven wrong. It's not to say you can't do it. It's just, as I said, it's rare, I think, that it feels natural to the reader. Because sometimes we just, as a reader, we think we're on a journey with one character. And then somebody else kind of comes in later on. And we're like, what is the purpose of this? Once we've established who our main character is, the reader can see this coming a mile away, right? Like, so yeah, that's kind of my worry. Not to say it can't be done, but I'm curious as you polish this up, kind of where you land on it.
Yeah, thank you. And I think my leaning right now is to actually just add a lot more of the other Matilda, because I think what I want to really get across with my sort of themes are the balance between their two perspectives. And I really want there to be equal weight to the other perspective as well. So I think I'm going to try to really add a lot more of her voice. So that's my plan. And then I'll make that come across clearly in the letter when I'm done. I think something I also noticed when I was rereading this, I didn't really include any personalization as to you or why I'm querying you. And so does that, I mean, I certainly that seems unusual, but how do you receive that?
Yeah, I mean, the personalization stuff is always kind of something where it makes me feel like, quote unquote, chosen. But by you emailing me, you are therefore choosing me. You know what I mean? It would be different if you just addressed it like, dear Mr. Agent X, or you know what I mean? Like, obviously, it's like you know how to spell my name. You wrote my name. So I get all of that. You could say like when you talk about, you know, the Great or the Matrix and the comps, you could say like, I know you're a fan of the Great because I'm sure I've tweeted about it, or I know you've read the Matrix, I know you're a Lauren Groff fan. Like, if you do know that about me, which I'm telling you now, so you know, that would be the type of thing you would include. The other thing I just realized when you said that is that you also didn't include anything but yourself. So that's probably why this query letter is on the more succinct side. But I was so blown away by the concept. Like, this is what happens, right? It's like agents, we always gravitate towards what is interesting to us. And as soon as something hooks us, we are just like blind to anything else that could be useful or interesting, right? I always say like the query's job is to hook an agent, and it doesn't really matter what you do otherwise, right? There's lots of rules that can be broken. And I think you did the job here of hooking me because you wrote a great query letter and this is an interesting book to me and it spoke to me.
Well, thank you. And yeah, I think as to your next question about the gaps in time, that's something that I certainly hope comes across well. I think as I'm editing, I'm really trying to make it much less sort of like summary of 5 years passing and much more episodes in this person's life as her perspective evolves. So, you know, time will tell whether that's working or not. But it is kind of challenging, certainly, because the book begins in 1128 and there's flashbacks all the way back to 1109 and it ends in the 1150s. Mm-hmm. So, you know, about 25 years plus flashbacks, that's quite a long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, it can be done. Like the Matrix, like she covers huge swaths of time. So definitely, it's definitely doable. And it's very common, as I said, like Philip Gregory does this, right? It's like we're covering a character, a fictional character's existence, right? And so there's so much to pack into there. And especially when we're tackling themes, you know, being a woman during that time and power and, you know, all of these other things that sometimes we need in a historical novels, we need a lot of time to be able to use the historical context, use what's happened in history to kind of add that fictional lens on top to build out that life, right? That's kind of one of the beautiful things about historical novels, right? We get to use that as a launch pad. Yeah.
Yeah. And then I think finally, I'll just say thank you for reminding me of Philippa Gregory because I haven't read her in so long. I really probably should read more of her books.
I haven't read a lot of her books. I went through a phase where in the early, like when we were slowly adopting to audiobooks, I went through a phase where like I listened to every single one of her audiobooks and I haven't read any of her new books. So now it's reminding me to get back into her too.
Yeah, I always see her on the shelves. I mean, she's prolific. So there'd be a lot of places to jump in. But I think that's it for me from questions. So thank you so much for all that feedback.
Wonderful. Just a reminder that when you are having a dual POV novel, you know, it needs to be that the novel that you envision cannot be told without both of those voices. And so you need to kind of relook at how you're telling the novel, not just to flesh out the other POV kind of for the reader, etc., to make it as compelling. You need to really sit down with your intention and say, why is this other POV integral to the telling of this novel? What am I unable to achieve if I do not include this other POV? So, you know, just guard against, I'm not saying you're doing this, but this is for our listeners, guard against just throwing in extra words in one POV just to kind of balance out the scales. That intentionality there needs to be so important. And remember that when you do dual POV, all the things that are in a single POV novel have to be there. You know, what is the character's want? What is their need? What is their misbelief? What are the stakes tied to it? What is their character arc? So, you know, it's double like the kind of work in terms of developing each character and having an inciting incident for each of their POVs, for having a key event for each of their POVs. So you've really, because you're going to be doing that much more work, you have to be 100% clear in your mind why that character's POV is essential to your novel. Okay, so Kate, can you give us an indication of what's in those opening pages?
Sure. So it begins in France in 1128, where Empress Matilda is having a horrible time at her own wedding feast. She's making her way through the messy drunken party that's happening in the castle's great hall, and she thinks back longingly to better days when she was an empress in Germany. Her father, the King of England, is present and quite drunk. He has married her to a much younger count for political reasons, and she sees her new husband as beneath her. This husband is also quite drunk. Matilda decides to taunt her new husband about their age gap.
Wonderful. Thank you. Okay, Carly, what was your take on that?
All right. So the query letter, I think, really established so much of what's happening here in a great way, right? We knew from the query letter there was going to be a modern tone. Like, we understood she was going to be a modern woman for the times. And so I think we really saw that in these pages, which was great. When I was a kid, I really loved the Royal Diary series from like the 90s and 2000s about like how all the different royal families in the world kind of made their way from that like YA perspective. And so I always loved doing these deep dives back into these moments in time, right? Where women were put in really complicated positions. And I always love books about power struggles, which I think at the heart, like, that's kind of what this is. And especially, I think what you're trying to do here, what I perceive that you're trying to do, is show the similarities between the limitations of a woman in that world and the limitations of a woman in our modern world, right? And so that's what I'm seeing that you're doing. And I think you're doing it really well in terms of like, this is five pages. So I barely am like, you know, getting into this, but I feel like I see you. I guess that's what I'm trying to tell you. Like, I see you and I think that's what you're doing. Then you're doing it really well. There's a certain level of empathy also that you create here. You know, she's witnessing the servants, like she's seeing people, right? And she's seeing them for who they are as people. And that's something that a lot of kind of royals wouldn't do back then. So the bit about the kind of age gap between her and her husband, because that's the main kind of conflict, I guess, if you want to say, of our first five pages, is she's basically saying, like, he's a teenager, right? And she's like, I'm a woman. And so we're figuring out how she's going to deal with this. And I think you do it pretty well in terms of explaining their ages, because you never want to be like, so-and-so character is 15 and so-and-so character is like 27, right? So I feel like you did a good job of explaining it. You know, you make him say kind of like that he's 15, and she says like, I was a widow, a full-grown woman. And so we eventually figure out, as I said, like she's 27. So there's a lot going on here that I think you're doing really well in terms of establishing that power structure is going to be the theme that's going to come. And power meaning she has a little bit of power over him because she's seen more life than him, right? But that's really the only power that she has other than her like familial power, but she's kind of giving that up, right? Because she's going to be a married woman to somebody else. So anyway, I think you're playing around with a lot of really interesting things here. I like the observations that she's making. One line you said, like, he was tall for his age, which would make us less look like mother and son, at least from a distance. So she's so aware of, you know, perception. And she's trying to grapple with, like, how is she going to be married to a 15-year-old? And so I'm curious a little bit about the ick factor a little bit. I don't know if you want to call it that. That's what I usually call it on the podcast, of like, you know, what that ick factor is going to be. It's historical. This is accurate to the times. Modern readers, obviously, there's a bit of ick there in terms of how far you're going to go down that road in terms of their relations. So I'm kind of curious from a reader perspective where you kind of imagine that to go. And I'm mostly curious about this other Matilda and how she's going to show up in these sort of themes that you're getting at in terms of like the different types of lives that women can live. And if you're only going to be examining women of a certain stratosphere, meaning like these two royals, how self-aware is that going to be? And I get the sense that you're going to be pretty self-aware about it, because one of our opening scenes, like, she's talking directly to a servant, which, you know, people of this level wouldn't. But yeah, no, I'm really into it. I think it's really interesting. I just wonder, as I said, when we're going to meet the other Matilda.
Thank you, Carly. Before we go back to Kate, I just want to say that 100% the ick factor, but that doesn't mean readers don't want to read it. Look at the success of My Dark Vanessa, Notes on a Scandal. You know, there's something to be said for readers' attraction to ick factor books. So, you know, there's that as well. Okay, Kate.
All right, thank you. Yeah, the ick factor was difficult for me as well, not wanting to change the ages of these historical people. And I guess to maybe spoil my own book a bit, I think I decided, maybe cowardly, maybe wisely, to sort of not have them consummate the marriage for reasons that actually I think are historically plausible. It turned out that they actually separated for several years after this point. And so I just decided to sort of dodge the ick factor. And I had the same issue actually with the flashbacks that are in her previous marriage, when she was basically sent to her previous husband when she was like 9. And then she was married when she was 12, which is horrific. And he was in his 20s. And so I struggled there as well with the flashbacks. And there's something so strange about historical fiction, about real people trying to sort of decide how much trauma to inflict on someone who existed, you know? And so I think there I also found a way to dodge it in ways that I hope are true to the, you know, character development.
Yeah. No, it's really interesting. I think, well, firstly, I want to read the whole book whenever you're done. So we can kind of get into this and figure out how much ick is the right amount of ick. Like, as you said, I mean, it's reality. It's not our reality. It was someone's reality. So yeah, I can't advise at this stage, but I definitely want to read more so I can let you know.
Yeah, thank you. And then the other Matilda. So this first wedding scene, the way that I've done it is sort of, it's a long, I don't know what you'd call it, technically, but it's sort of, this scene is going to span several chapters and it sort of be the catalyst for some flashbacks and some exposition, and different characters are going to talk to her at the wedding that allows different sort of information to come out. So maybe 20 minutes later in real time, but I think it's one or two chapters later in, you know, book time, she'll meet Stephen and talk to him. And also then the other Matilda will show up and they'll have a conversation. And then there'll be some action involving the other Matilda as well. So she'll show up in this scene, but not immediately in the pages.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Because I think, especially with the title, right, the other Matilda, there's a sense of rivalry. So the faster that we meet her, or at least see her from across the room, the better. Because whether it is a perceived or unknown rivalry, or how we imagine it to be, yeah, her showing up sooner rather than later in some capacity, I think would be interesting.
That's a really good point, that seeing her across the room might be something we could do on even the first page to sort of
And I think there's so many ways to think about it, right? Like, it could be in juxtaposition of her physically. I don't know if they look the same or different. Intellectually, age, right? Like, again, we're talking about, this book is about power struggles and how different women exist, right? So, and at this period of time, what did women have to offer, right? And what is she offering that this Matilda is not? So I think there's some interesting things we could play with as early as possible.
Just something I want to add there as well, something that's going to be vitally important early on is their impressions of each other, you know, because you're going to be revealing in each of these characters' viewpoints who they are themselves. But remember, how the other woman views them is going to be really integral as well to this kind of novel. So, you know, not just seeing her across the room, but forming an impression about her. Same when we go to the other Matilda's viewpoint, she should have an impression, whether it's right or wrong or whatever the case may be, is about the other Matilda. And just while we keep saying the other Matilda, I'm thinking how tough this is going to be for you to make sure in each character's viewpoint that the reader knows which Matilda we are dealing with. So how are you going to address that, Kate, to really, really differentiate them besides, you know, putting their name and their last name at the top of the chapter?
Yeah, that's a great question, Bianca. And that's something that I've struggled with kind of in writing this. I really like the fact they're both named Matilda. I think that has a lot of promise. But it's something that I think is sort of, it sounds so irritating to read a book where both main characters have the same name. Like, why would you do that? And I've read other novels that are about these people, or at least mention them, and they always change one of the names to a similar name or to a different language just to make it less confusing.
How about a nickname? Maybe one of them just has, you know, a nickname that they've been known as since a child, you know, Matty, or I don't know, just something that's going to help there in terms of the differentiation.
Yeah, that certainly could help. Right now, the main POV is the first person Empress Matilda POV, and the third person POV is the other Matilda, which is, you know, a bit of a kind of a structural cue, but it also might make the other Matilda's POV less appealing if it's not first person. So I may have to kind of keep playing with that and see if that's the right way to do it.
I mean, not necessarily. If you do third person super close, remember, there's a way to write third person close that it actually can sometimes feel closer than first person, because the narrator even knows things about this character that they themselves may not even know, you know? So I think you've been smart there in terms of doing first person and third person. And I think if you do a third person super close, that will really help. And, you know, that nickname as well might help as well.
I just want to come back to how these two Matildas are going to interact. So in the query letter, you describe the other Matilda as radiant and adorable. And we don't really have too many cues about our Empress Matilda. So I was thinking in this scene where it's like, it's Empress Matilda's wedding, if a servant or somebody comments on the other Matilda, right? To be like, we are now comparing Matildas, right? We're setting up this this dichotomy of like, there's one Matilda and then there's the other. Which one is the other Matilda, right? Who is the main character of this story? Which Matilda is going to be the one that has the legacy of the Matilda? Do you know what I'm trying to say? So I think right away we have to establish like other people are talking about the other Matilda. Even though it's Empress Matilda's wedding, other Matilda's there. You know what I mean?
That actually goes so well, Carly, in terms of Jessica Brody's Save the Cat writes a novel, because she says that in Act One, there should be a secondary character who says something that actually sets up the whole theme for the novel. And so your suggestion works perfectly in line with that, because this whole thing is about, you know, the whether it's competition or whatever between the two women. So having a secondary character say something along those lines definitely achieves that goal.
And it's also like a modern conundrum, which is like, we have this theory even with modern women, like there can only be one woman at the top, right? And so again, modern themes are coming through. Anyway, as I could talk about this book forever, because I think I've only read 5 pages, right? And I think you're setting up something really, really interesting here. So well done you.
Thank you. That's very helpful. And yeah, I think that's given me an idea that I might want the young husband, Jeffrey, to say something about the other Matilda. And that can really piss our Matilda off.
Yeah. Like, what is the other Matilda younger? Is the other Matilda closer to his age? Because I think that
they're
could
be interesting. They're about the same age. I mean, I could in real life, but I could change that.
I know. I was just thinking, like, what if it looks like that other Matilda would have been a better match for him, but ended up with Empress Matilda. Right. Anyway, I'm just spitballing here. Like, she's obviously married to
Well, Steven. I think that, yeah, the physicality is that I think our Matilda is kind of, she's really tall for a woman and she has kind of severe features, or at least she perceives herself that way. And the other Matilda is very sort of, you know, matronly and plump and sort of beautiful and glowing and, you know, kind of all these very feminine characteristics. And so maybe that's what the men point out is, you know, oh, she looks like such a great wife.
Yeah, because the other thing is like, they're going to be expected to make heirs, right? And if she's 27, she's perceived to be old. Mm-hmm. And if the other one's very matronly looking, that's presumably she looks like she's more able to have children, right? And like, mm-hmm. that's, you know, the perceptions of the time. So anyway, yeah, I think all the groundwork's there, right? I think you just got to pull the lever on things.
Okay, thank you so much.
Wonderful, Carly. Thank you. Okay, let's go to today's guest.
After spending our summer vacation this year in Europe, it opened my eyes and my kids' eyes to the power of language and finding common ground no matter who we are and where we are. One of the most important things to me as a parent of two is making sure my kids see other places in the world and are exposed to the languages they speak around the globe. They're in French immersion education, and I'm honestly already getting left behind. I took French class in school until grade 9, and I have a big gap in my learning that I'm ready to fill. And that's why I rely on Rosetta Stone, the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, and it truly immerses you in the languages that you want to learn. I know my kids' language learning skills are going to explode past me, and I'm ready to catch them, and that's why we have Rosetta Stone. It's a trusted expert for 30 years with millions of users and 25 languages offered. We're talking Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, Arabic, Polish, and many, many more. There is fast language acquisition. Rosetta Stone immerses you in many ways. There are no English translations, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in that language. There's an intuitive process. You're picking up a language naturally. First with words, and then with phrases, and then sentences. And it is designed for long-term retention. There is speech recognition technology. It is called True Accent. It is built in. It's a feature that gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. It's convenient. There is super flexible learning anytime, anywhere. Learn on the go with a mobile app or on your desktop at your schedule. There is amazing value because you have lifetime membership for all 25 languages for any and all trips and languages that you need in life. That is a steal. That is 25 language courses from Rosetta Stone that they offer it for 50% off. So don't put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. So go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. I am so excited to share that I am teaching my super popular Hacking Writing on a Line Level class in November. And this time, it's a 3-day event. We'll spend the first 2 days learning rules and techniques that will help you elevate your writing. And then the third day will be dedicated for Q&A. This class is filled with examples, and I mean it, all examples all the time. So you will leave with an invaluable toolkit to hack your own writing on a line level. Check out the link in my bio on Instagram for more information. I hope to see you there.
Liv Constantine is the pen name of sisters Lynn Constantine and Valerie Constantine. Lynn and Valerie are nationally and internationally best-selling authors with more than 1.5 million copies sold worldwide. Their books have been translated into 29 languages, published in 34 countries, optioned for development in both television and film, and praised by the Wall Street Journal, USA Today, the Sunday Times, the Washington Post, People, Good Morning America, among many others. Their debut novel, The Last Mrs. Parrish, was a Reese's Book Club selection. And you have to have been living under a rock if you hadn't heard about, at the very least, if not read, The Last Mrs. Parrish. Valerie and Lynn, it is such a pleasure to have you both back on the show. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah, we've got a lot to unpack today. So before we dive into it, I am going to read for our listeners the flap copy for the book we're discussing today, which is the highly anticipated sequel, The Next Mrs. Parrish. So here we go. Here is our flap copy to give you some context. Amber Patterson Parrish has come a long way from being an invisible wallflower. Her hard work and immaculate planning have paid off now that she's a prominent socialite, but that doesn't mean there haven't been bumps along the way. Less than a year since her husband Jackson's tax evasion scandal, Amber is still at the top of the Bishop's Harbor community pecking order, free to do as she wishes while Jackson sits in prison. But that freedom is quickly coming to an end. With Jackson getting released from prison, Amber's time and money is vanishing. Meanwhile, Daphne Parrish left Bishop's Harbor after her divorce from Jackson Parrish, swearing she would never go back. But when one of her daughters runs away from home, desperate to see her father, Daphne agrees to return for the summer to allow him supervised visits. Once out of prison, Jackson swears he's a changed man. But Daphne knows all too well that he can't be trusted. When a ghost from Amber's past emerges looking for revenge, the three of them find unlikely allies in one another. But who is playing who? When all is said and done, they'll have to fight tooth and nail for everything they have left in the zero-sum game. With shocking turns and entertaining characters, The Next Mrs. Parrish will make you rethink everything you thought you knew about duplicity and betrayal. Dun, dun, dun. Right, so for our listeners, you know that when you guys send in your query letters and your opening pages for our agents to critique on the podcast, many of you will say, this is the first in a series, or I am working on a series. And we often say, it's maybe not best to say this because it is so difficult to publish a series. The first book has to be highly successful before a publisher or an agent will say, okay, we're going to publish the sequel. Now, when it comes to Valerie and Lynn, I was having a look. I mean, The Last Mrs. Parrish came out in 2017, which means you guys probably sold it in like 2015, which means you probably finished writing it like a year before. So we're looking at 10 years later in terms of the sequel coming out. So I have questions. Firstly, why now? And was the sequel always the plan?
So, no, the sequel was not always the plan. And yes, you're right. It's been a while. It was actually 2016 when we sold the book. So it had been, as you know, our books are all standalones. And The Last Mrs. Parrish was a book that people and readers would ask us about, even at subsequent book readings, you know, because we've written four other books, and they would say, are you going to write a sequel to The Last Mrs. Parrish? And we would always say, well, you never know. But then we would leave and look at each other and say, no, we just had no intention. But what ended up happening is a few years ago, we wrote a prequel novella as an Audible original, and it was all about Amber. It's called The First Shot. And in that novella, a new character emerged at the very end who we fell in love with, and her name was Daisy. And so as we kept thinking about that and continued to be asked the same question, we said, well, maybe we should talk about it. And when we were able to come up with an idea for how to continue the story in a way that would be as engaging, if not more engaging, that's when we seriously began talking and plotting it. And once we came up with the story, we said, okay, we'll give it a shot. And that's when we did it. Because, you know, we were never intent when just writing it because the first book was popular. And we didn't want to do a disservice to the first book. You know, these are characters that we love, that our readers love, and we had to make sure that the continuation of their story was something that made sense and that would be compelling. And so with great trepidation, we did, and waited with bated breath for the first reviews. And we've been very thrilled at the reception that it's received. And people have really said that they love it. And in many cases, like it more than the first book, which we never expected.
Wow. I mean, that's incredible. And yes, one, give the people what they want. When people are constantly asking about this character, certainly it means it's touched a nerve and they do absolutely love it. But I love what you said about you weren't going to do it unless the story felt authentic, unless it felt as good as the first one could be, because, you know, that book did so well because of the twists and turns, because people didn't know what to expect from these characters. And you hid so much from the reader, creating all of this tension. And then, of course, when you go to a sequel, the reader knows a lot of this stuff. So how can you make it as suspenseful, as twisty and turny, as full of tension, but making it a whole new story without rehashing the old stuff? So can we just backtrack and go to the prequel? What was it that made you want to dive into the prequel? I know Audible at one point was really very aggressively acquiring content for Audible originals. I myself did an Audible original as well many years ago. Was it a case of they approached you and said, would you be interested in doing a prequel? Or was it a case of you knew this character so well, you really wanted to explore her backstory, and this was something you pitched to them?
Yes, we were approached and were able to come up with a story. And we thought that it would be really interesting to look into Amber's background. And when she left home and left a child behind, between that time and the time that she found Jackson Parish. And so that created the first shot. And we found out things about Amber that we didn't know, secrets that she was hiding. And as Lynn said, we discovered this new character, Daisy, because her father was the target that Amber honed in on for her first rich husband. And something happens in that prequel that makes Daisy hate Amber and want justice. And so we really felt that bringing these characters into the story, there was more to tell, that there was more to tell about how Daisy was going to get that justice, what was going to happen to Amber, and how that might all come together. And that was the thread that really started the knitting process of putting that story together.
Yeah, you know, for our listeners, you've heard us talk before about Lisa Cron in terms of story genius. She has a lot of theory about a character's backstory in terms of their misbelief, in terms of their origin story. And one of the things that I really loved about the original Mrs. Parish book was that we were thrown into it. We knew what Amber really wanted. We knew what she was prepared to do to get it. We knew that there were high stakes. It was very clear there was a character who wanted something very specific and would stop at nothing to get it. But we weren't slowed down by all of the backstory, everything that made Amber the way she was. And often in stories, we don't need that. But it is wonderful for the writer to know all of this. And like you say, find out even more as you delve into that, because it does allow for prequels and it does allow for plot twists and turns down the way. Now, when you sat and plotted out that particular story, and when you sat and plotted out this story, can you take us through again? You plot every single thing before you begin writing. Take me through it, Lynn.
So we always joke that we're not plotters, we're not pantsers, we're plancers.
Right, yes.
Right. So we are definitely a combination of the two. And so for the first book, we knew what the twist was, and we knew what the outcome was, but we didn't know what was going to happen all along the way. And that really got written chapter by, you know, pretty much chapter by chapter, with the exception again of knowing. Now for the second book was different because, yes, we had to know ourselves whether or not we had enough for a story. So we did write, I think, maybe a 7 or 8 page summary saying generally what was going to happen, how these characters were going to interact. You know, but again, not that step by step, you know, there was a lot of movement within that as we wrote the book. So it was a different process for each, but just as, you know, luckily just as fun. I mean, I think this has been the most fun book of, and we always have fun with our books because we do a lot of laughing and, you know, we love working together, But these characters are very special to us. So it was a real joy to come back to them and see where they were going to take us. And then again, to bring in Daisy Ann and develop her further, because she's a real spitfire and somebody that we both love a lot.
In terms of the challenge of coming back to a character after you've left them and moved on, and there've been so many different characters since then. I mean, you guys have written some incredible books since then. And how many were there since then? Five or six?
There were four more in between. So yes, this is the sixth Liv book, right? You know, not counting Word Stories.
Right. So in terms of coming back to being in these characters' heads, when you've now since been in so many different characters' heads, I know you guys did the prequel, so you got to spend time with her again, but how do you immerse yourself in that voice again? Because even though, you know, you're writing three different characters, we're looking at three different POVs, there was a particular way that you have to immerse yourself in character in terms of their personality, how they view the world, the lens through which they view the world, the limitations they have in terms of lack of empathy, lack of self-awareness, etc., etc. So each time you write a particular character, you need to write them in a very particular way in order for them to come alive authentically on the page. Was it a case of going back to the first book, reviewing that, really like immersing yourself and getting settled into that voice? Or was it just you knew these characters so well, you were just able to sit down and fully bring them to life immediately?
I think it was much of the latter, that we knew these characters so well. I think there's also something about that first book that is sort of your baby. And so these were characters that we still talked about and felt that they almost seemed real to us. And then the fact, of course, that the first shot, the prequel, was a little more recent. And so that took us back into the whole Amber personality and persona. So yes, we did, of course, go back to Mrs. Parrish and talk about what had happened. The challenge, of course, was to not repeat things, you know, repeat backstory. We wanted this to be a standalone so that a reader didn't have to have read the last Mrs. Parrish or the first shot and still would know what was happening. But in the case of people who had read the last Mrs. Parrish, we didn't want to keep repeating, well, here's what Jackson did and here's what them. So we did have to come up with new scenarios that conveyed what had happened, but that were different so that we wouldn't bore those readers. But I think these characters have been very much alive for us for these past 10 years, and we love writing about them.
In terms of timeline consistency, so I don't think you ever date stamped any of these things. It wasn't, this is the year in which this is happening, etc., which a lot of novelists do. They'll be like, you know, 2020, April 2020. So this book sort of takes place, you pick up, I think it's 1 year after the last one ended, right? So when you sat down to write it, was it clear in your head that this story takes place in 2000 and whatever, so that you can consistently maintain that, so that you weren't introducing technology that hasn't been invented or fashion that hasn't yet come out? Was that something in your mind, or was it a case of, we're just going to skirt around politics and that kind of thing so that we don't have to worry about that timeline consistency, considering that you were writing it 10 years after you wrote the last one?
Yeah, I mean, we try to avoid that because, you know, people are going to be reading this book 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and you don't want it to be dated. So yes, of course, fashions are going to change. But even if you mention television shows, I mean, you know, we all watch shows that were out 10 years ago now with everything streaming and books. So we definitely try to keep that out because it's confusing enough just remembering how old everyone is and, you know, keeping all of that straight, right? They will have to, you know, go back and look at all of that and look at the seasons, you know, okay, when was this again? But in terms of, yeah, the outside world, it's just contemporary and we don't really want to narrow it down to a specific year.
Yeah, that's a smart choice. So we often say on the podcast, if you are going back and basing something in the 80s or you're basing it in the 90s, just for the sake of nostalgia, it needs to be something more than that, that is happening in the historical context, that the story is happening then because it couldn't happen at any other time for this, you know, exact reason. Right. So how did you decide where to begin when you came back to this? Because you could have started it 6 months later, you could have started it 2 years later, 3 years later. So when you sat down to go, okay, this is where we're beginning it, Was it a case of a bit of backwards and forwards to try and find the right landing spot? Because I always say that starting a book is like circling a building and you're trying to find your way into the story. And, you know, you have to be intentional with where you're going to start. It has to start at that particular spot for a very specific reason. So were you both sort of brainstorming ways of how to approach this? Or was it, okay, we're going to have it as soon as he's coming out of prison, because that makes sense in terms of an inciting incident, as it were?
Yeah, I think that was definitely the case. There really wasn't any decision, you know, or any question about when it would start. We knew that his prison term was a year. And so it was a year later, because he would be getting out of prison. This would set it up nicely for Amber, who is running out of money while he's in prison, and that whole conflict between them. And then Daphne in California with her children and being in therapy, but it's still new enough, this separation from their father, and they are still feeling the effects of this trauma of just being sort of ripped away from him. And that is what compels Tallulah to try and run away and see her father. So all of these events come together, and that just seemed the perfect timing to be able to do that.
What you both do so incredibly well in your stories is that you set us up immediately with characters who have very specific wants or needs that are tied to very high stakes. Because, you know, as a creative writing instructor and someone who edits work, that's the biggest issue I see with emerging authors, who give a character who's kind of there with a, there I was minding my own business when this kind of happened, and they kind of get pulled along, but they don't specifically want anything. And I keep saying it doesn't really matter what the character wants at the beginning of the story, so long as they desperately want it and there are high stakes tied to it and their wants and needs can change throughout the story, but they need to desperately want something. And once again, you begin with all three of your main characters really wanting something specifically. Now, Amber in the first book was real social climber. She really wanted this wealth. She wanted the prestige, etc. So I was going, how are Valerie and Lynn going to do this in the second book, considering she got what she wanted, right? But then you go, okay, be careful what you wish for or you will surely have it. So you guys managed to go, okay, I'm going to give her something different that she wants, because this time she's running out of money. So again, was that a very conscious decision that you sat down and said, okay, what is it that she desperately needs as we begin the story? Or is it that you two are at the point of storytelling where you just instinctively understand how story works? And so you know a character needs to start off by wanting something and chasing that specific thing that they want.
Yeah, I think it's intuitive. It's interesting because we're often asked about that. Or do you do this, you know, how do you look at your three act structure? And do you know at which point this is going to happen? And that would be paralyzing for both of us. I mean, we just sort of let the story unfold. And again, we do know, obviously, that we want every chapter to move the story forward. We want to have tension. We want to have conflict, because, you know, it has to be interesting. And I think for Amber, I mean, yes, her want starts out to be one thing and it changes through the story, right? It becomes something else, even more compelling. And that was something we had to really make sure we drove home, so that it wasn't like, well, why? She could just do, you know, we won't give spoilers. So she could just stick with her original want, which she sort of gets pretty quickly, and move on and live her life. But then something else happens. And because of the way Amber is and her pride and her, you know, sense of entitlement, that becomes even stronger than the original want, and that propels her forward in a completely different direction that she had never intended to go. So, yeah, I mean, I think we just try to do our best to embody them and to really understand, okay, what would she do in this situation? She would go here, and what would Daphne do? You know, she's the mother. She's always going to put her children above herself, and she knows when you come back to Jackson or, you know, in his orbit, anything can happen, but she's willing to take that risk because she's primarily concerned with her daughter. And then with Daisy Ann, it's a whole completely thing. It's sort of a combination. Yes, she wants to protect her family, but also she's got this really strong sense of justice and right and wrong. And, you know, she's sort of, in some ways, her worldview can be kind of rigid to a point. But again, there's growth in her journey, and what she starts out wanting veers a little bit, and she kind of comes to realize what's most important. So I think, you know, that we try to just go on the journey with the characters as you would, you know, in life or with your friends.
Yeah. And something you said there, Lynn, is also so important in terms of causality. When it comes to a plot, you need dominoes tipping. You need A happens, which leads to B, which leads to C. So one thing causes the next, which causes the next, as opposed to these satellite plot points that all orbit each other, but are in no way linked to each other. And I think because I write the same way you both write. In fact, I don't even do the 8-page outline. That to me is even paralyzing. I'm just like, let's just see where this damn thing goes and we're going to go from there. But I think if you really do pay attention to causality, I think a plot will organically unfold from there. Because as you say, as one thing happens, which could be an obstacle or whatever, it moves the plot in a different direction quite organically. So you can, as a writer, go, okay, I just need to get her from A to B. And once we get to B, these are the options that are open to her. So which option is she going to take? And then that allows you as writers to go, okay, because I know my character, I know that this is the option she would choose because it's most organic to her. So can you speak a bit about that, Val?
I think that, yes, definitely that's the way it works. And you have to really know your characters well in order to make them authentic, their choices authentic. And so that the reader thinks, yes, that is something that Amber would do, or that is what Daphne would do. When Daphne puts herself back into Jackson's orbit because of her daughter's need to see her father again, she knows that it's going to be perilous. He most assuredly has not changed, but she puts herself in danger in a compromising situation because of the need of her child. And that is something that Daphne would do, because we've seen in the past what she has done and the lengths she's gone to protect her children. And so definitely is that element of really knowing the psychology of your character, how they think, what they want, what they're afraid of, the lengths to which they're willing to go. And I think that once the writer understands that, then going from A to B to C becomes much clearer.
So jumping off of what you just said about character psychology, I mean, is Amber, I go backwards and forwards, is she a sociopath? She's certainly narcissistic. So was it a case of you had to sit down and kind of decide, okay, this is how she is, and we need to research the psychology of this kind of character, the traits that they would have? Or again, it's kind of like method acting. You just immerse yourself in that character and go, okay, she's a bit of a narcissist. She's a bit of a sociopath. She doesn't feel guilt about things. She doesn't lie awake at night worrying about hurting people's feelings. She goes for what she wants. And so therefore, this is how we're going to put together the character psychology.
She's a total sociopath. She's not a bit. She's a complete sociopath, complete narcissist. But whether she was born that way or made, again, she doesn't really have a traumatic childhood. But yes, she does not have the same feelings that a normal person has. But what's interesting about Amber is that she has a rationale that can explain away all of that. So whether it's, the reason that she's easily able to leave her son because he's kind of boring and, maybe when he's older, he'll be more interesting. Or, if she does something to sideline someone, she can say, well, they're better off because now, like when she got rid of her boss in the first book, now she can retire and spend time with her grandchildren. And it's not that she even needs it to make herself feel better. It's just she wants to be able to think that she's okay, that there's nothing wrong with her. And similar to that, I mean, I would actually say, even though Jackson does horrible things, not excusing them at all, he has a different psychology in that he's damaged, and he has a very flawed belief that what he is doing is for the benefit of having his family. Now, yes, he wants to control and he doesn't think he's a bad guy. Like Amber doesn't care whether she's bad or good, I don't think. But Jackson wants to see himself as a good father and a good husband, even though he's anything but. And again, his actions and his dialogue shore that up. And I think, we do research. I have a good friend who's a psychologist. And when we started years ago, we talked about those, traits and those sort of things. And some of the red flags even that Daphne would see dating Jackson that she ignored. So it's a combination of all of that. And it is a bit of method acting where you sort of do try to get into that head and feel like what's going on. So it's an amalgamation of all of that.
What you two have both done so incredibly well as well is writing an unlikable female protagonist that everybody's obsessed with and that they wanted more of. And yet, when I speak to emerging writers these days, and I've even had it with some of my own work, is that you get the feedback, well, we don't like her. You know, she's not sympathetic enough. And it's like, why must women characters be sympathetic? Why must they be likable? We don't have a problem with male characters who are awful and diabolical, and that's cool. But women need to be the warm and fuzzies. And yet you guys have completely flipped that on its head and made this character who's so bloody awful and yet so compelling. So for our listeners who are writing these kinds of female characters, how do you keep readers invested in their story, even if they're not really rooting for them? Because that's the thing. Like, we generally say that readers need to be rooting for your character. They need to want what your character wants. They need to want to have them succeed. Do you think your readers hate Reed Amber and are hoping to see her comeuppance? Do you think that they are living vicariously through her because they're like, oh my God, what would it be like to be a woman in the world who doesn't give a shit what anyone else thinks? Like, how is it that you pull off this alchemy of getting people to turn pages with a character they don't like?
You know, I think she's the character that people love to hate because she is so outrageous, but she also has some good qualities. I mean, things that are admirable, her tenacity, her focus, her desire to keep learning and reading and improving herself, to study art, to study music, to read philosophy and the classics, learning a language. And she has a sense of humor. I mean, some of the things that she says are funny. And I think that one of the reviews that we laughed out loud when we read it was the first line of the Kirkus review, and that was, "The bitch is back." And I think they just like the outrageousness of her and to see what she's going to do, even though they're rooting for the other team and they want to see her fail at what she's trying to do. But it's still just so interesting. And it probably is a combination of, yeah, wouldn't it be great to be a person who just doesn't give a shit and says whatever they want? Because I think we all feel that at times. We're like, how many times have you said, you know, what I wish I had been able to say was blah, 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 blah. But we keep all of that tamped down. Not Amber. I mean, she's just out there and living her life large.
And I think the other thing, too, is that she does come into contact with some other characters who are terrible, and she puts them in their place. And that is really fun to watch whether she's heading off with Jackson and he can't get over on her, or like this another character in the book who's a real misogynist jerk. And, you know, and you like to see her kind of just tell him that and what her internal thoughts are. So, and as Valerie said, she is funny. I mean, we listened to the audio, we loved the audio, and the audio narrators were amazing. And we were just laughing at how that's just the things that she does and the things that she says. And we do. We get emails saying, "I hope you're writing a book 3. We need more Amber." That's what they want. More Amber.
I think what also works as well is her interiority, in terms of what you said earlier, Lynn, is that she can justify her behavior all the time. Like, to her, it's completely rational. And there's times that you get sucked into the psychology where you find yourself nodding along with some awful things she's thinking of doing. And then you're like, hold on a minute. No, this is messed up. And I think, you know, that's the big key to it, is that the reader kind of gets sucked in into this mind space and is like, yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, the way she's thinking is rational. And the only other time I've seen that done so well was with the book, where again, you spend all this time in this protagonist's head who's an awful person. But there were times that I was like hoping he'd get away with murder and all kinds of things. And then I was like, what does this say about me? I'm rooting for, again, another psychopath. This is completely wrong. So, I mean, our time is up. It is always so wonderful chatting to you both. For our listeners, if you're writing these kinds of female protagonists, you have got to study Val and Lynn's books. You've got to study this character just to see how they're able to do it. And if you haven't read the first one, read it. Read the second one. Read them all. They're all page turners. They're absolutely incredible. And we really look forward to seeing what you both do next.
Thank you so much. It's great talking to you. Yes.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. Fantasy writers, I hope you'll be joining me for the All About Fantasy full-day virtual retreat on the 28th of September from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern Time. Whether you write YA fantasy, romantasy, adult fantasy, epic fantasy, cozy fantasy, dystopian fiction, or any other variation of the genre, you won't want to miss out on this amazing day of learning dedicated especially to you and those writing in your genre. The lineup includes award-winning and best-selling authors, as well as literary agents and editors who specialize in the genre. You'll have an opportunity to submit your query letter for critique. The Story Engine, who is sponsoring the retreat, is also hosting an awesome giveaway of an All Things Fantasy storytelling package that contains a copy of each of their decks, Story Engine deck and deck of worlds, each with their associated fantasy expansions, the mythology, dystopian, and fairy tale boosters, valued at $237. All delegates will also receive discounts when shopping on the Story Engine website. Come and learn, ask questions, and even more importantly, build community. To find out more and to register, go to my website, biancamaray.com, and look for the All About Fantasy tab. I hope to see you there. Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre and time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. Now, this particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 30th of September, with the matchup emails going out on the 1st of October. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab.